We're still in Psalm 105. I believe we got down to, verse 12? And again, we're dealing with a review of Israel's history. And it's a good reminder. We need to remember where we came from. Israel needed to have that reminder of God's dealing in their past, that God is the God who is the God of Israel. And that, as we saw in verses 6 and 7, that he is our God and has done all these magnificent things for the covenant people. Now, we have a tendency, guilty here, we have a tendency to think God is with us and backing us up and really on our side when things are going well. And when things are not going well, at least from our perspective, then we seem to think that, God has abandoned me. Woe is me. What has happened that God has abandoned me? And it's not the case. Very often we go through trials and difficulties. We're actually going to be talking about that a little bit in the morning service. We go through trials and difficulties in part for preparation of something that's going to follow. And we have that in verse 12. Now, understand, it says, when they were few in number, very few, and strangers in it. So they have come from Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham came from originally, down near the Iraq-Kuwait border today. Traveled up to northern Iraq, lived in Haran for a little while until his dad died. And then he went south through Syria and through most of what is now Israel, and settled in the south of what is now Israel. He's a foreigner. It's kind of interesting. In America, we don't think too much of once people have been here a generation or two, they're part of the deal. The accent's gone, the culture has pretty much been assimilated, and yet, in a lot of places around the world, you can be 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 10th generation. You're still a foreigner. Different places around the world like that. Some countries are set up that way very deliberately. Yoshi, when he was with us, Yoshi's mother is Chinese. But she was born in Japan. But she's Chinese. She has to have a Chinese passport in order to live in Japan, even though she's married to somebody who's Japanese. It's just they don't assimilate, and they make it very clear that you are an outsider, you are a foreigner, and so they're strangers in the land that God has promised them. It says in verse 13, they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, and going back and forth to Egypt and to the Philistines there with Abraham and Isaac. And it says in verse 14, he suffered no man to do them wrong, yet he reproved kings for their sake. We see this a couple of times, even though sometimes Abraham and Isaac, they both followed the same pattern. They said that, because they both had evidently, really beautiful wives. And so when they went into a new territory, Isaac and Abraham said to their wives, hey, when we get there, tell everybody that you are my sister. And that way, because otherwise they're going to see how gorgeous you are and they're going to bump me off so they can get you. And that particular lie, which was what it was, got both these fellows into some trouble, but God protected them in spite of themselves. In spite of themselves, they were rebuked for it, but they were by the kings. But at the same time, the kings were withheld from doing anything to them. As a matter of fact, in the situation with Isaac, God had revealed himself to the Philistine king to protect him. I think I've got the text there in Genesis. And in the situation with Abraham, he told the Philistine king that my servant is a prophet and he will pray for you and fix the problem that I have brought upon you. So, protected from outsiders, protected from oppression, even though there's just a small group of people. Picture the lay of the land during the time of the patriarchs, all right, in Canaan. you had a scattering of city-states. Each town is responsible for itself. And they may have some regional alliances. You also had at least three and possibly as many as a half a dozen different ethnic groups scattered around in these various city-states. When they went in and conquered the time of the conquest, you had the Canaanites. They were the dominant thing. You also had Philistines, who were totally unrelated. You had Hittites, who are mentioned just in passing. The Hittites had a few city-states that were trading posts. Where were the Hittites from? They were from Turkey. You had a number of other folks that were there in the land, different Arab groups from further east. And so a very much of a hodgepodge as far as the peoples there were concerned. Did you have a central authority? No, you didn't. The cities were responsible for themselves, for the most part. Might have, like I said, a confederacy. And if somebody looked at all of Abraham's stuff, or all of Isaac's stuff. He was very wealthy. Talks about that the Philistines envied him. It was very much within their power to just grab it all, bump him off, and be done with it. There was nobody to restrain them except God. And God preserved these guys in the situation they were, even though it was not necessarily an ideal situation as far as safety was concerned. So God's protection. And then it says in verse 16, here's where we run into into some problems that they don't have any control over. It says, moreover, he called for a famine upon the land. He brake the whole staff of bread. This would be the famine that was predicted in conjunction with the time of Joseph. It says, and he sent a man before them, even Joseph. Now, that's a key thing. Verse 17, God sent Joseph before them, who was sold as a servant or slave, whose feet were hurt with fetters, and he was laid in iron, had shackles on. Now, why did God allow Joseph to be envied, hated by his brothers, and sold into slavery, and sent down to Egypt with the brothers' intention of, now he's gone. We are done with our brother. We didn't kill him, but he's gone. As good as dead. He's gone. Now, God knew all that in advance, obviously, and God, it says, sent him down to Egypt in preparation for this. Now, here's poor Joseph, and we're going to see this here in just a moment. Does he know for, let's see, he's in the house of Potiphar, probably for several years. He's 17 when he gets sold into slavery. He's in the house of Potiphar for a while. And he's striving to do what's right, and then he is under great temptation obstacles. He is slandered for doing right, and then he's put into prison. And he's in prison for a number of years. Now, is there any light at the end of the tunnel for Joseph? No, circumstances just keep getting worse. And he has no understanding of, now I will tell you this, he does have some light at the end of the tunnel. Now let's look at our text here. He sent a man before them, talks about it, until the time that his word came, the word of the Lord tried him. Why did Joseph's brothers hate him? There are several reasons. Okay, let's say some hands because I'm just hearing. Okay, here first. All right, he was the favorite, daddy's favorite, which is not necessarily Joseph's problem, but Jacob's problem, but still. Okay, another one. All right, there were only two of the boys that had Rachel as mom, and Rachel was the favored wife, at least initially. Okay. What else?
The dreams.
It says, and they hated him yet the more because of his dreams. That you will bow before me. Well, I'm sure that's to ingratiate favor with his brothers that already despise him. And yet that was revelation from God. And if that's a revelation from God as a prophecy, which is indicated here in the passage, when is that going to come to pass? When is that going to be fulfilled that my brothers will come and bow before me? Because they haven't done this to this point, which also means that there has to be somewhere down the road a reconciliation to some extent, or at least there has to be a meeting. And that hasn't happened yet. So I've gone from being a favored slave to being slandered and now thrown into prison. Now granted, I'm in the prison. I've gotten a little bit of favored status because of my abilities and so on, but I'm still in prison. Can't go anywhere. I'm in charge of the jail. I'm the warden, but I can't leave. And yet, because of something that God showed him when he was a teenager, there's a light at the end, but he has no idea of a timetable. This is very parallel to David, who as a teenager is anointed king by the promise of God. When's it going to happen? All right? I've been brought into the court, and now I'm fleeing for my life. I was made the king's son-in-law, and now I'm a wanted felon, as far as the king is concerned. When is the promise of God that I got as a teenager going to come to pass? Here I am, I'm, you know, in my late 20s, years have gone by, and what's going to happen to me? Joseph could say the same thing. Very similar timetable, by the way, as well. But God sent him down there. It says, until the time, verse 19, that his word came, the word that the Lord tried him. And God prepared Joseph for the task. One of the reasons I think he was in Egypt so long is so that he would be acclimatized to understanding the Egyptians thoroughly. They had a very, very different culture than the folks there in Canaan. Spoke a different language. Not even a related language. And so he gets thoroughly assimilated to what it's like to be an Egyptian. Understands their thinking and everything else. Verse 20, here's the change. The king sent and loosed him, even the ruler of the people, and let him go free and made him lord of his house and ruler all of his substance. Now, understand, from what we see in Genesis, the indication is that Joseph's in prison. He's been there for years. And doing what he normally does. And sometime, probably late morning, mid to late morning, because remember the Pharaoh woke up and had the dream, and he couldn't get answers from his normal dream interpreter guys, you know. And so, the cupbearer, hearing about this, says, oh, there was this guy and so this all comes down, and so they hurry and get him. It says Joseph shaved because, you know, the Egyptians, higher ups anyway, were clean shaven. And he gets cleaned up and everything, and he's brought in before Pharaoh. So from the time Pharaoh wakes up, explains the dream, doesn't get the answers, the cupbearer gets the epiphany, and then they send in, and they hurry and get him. So from the time that he gets the word till the time he's standing before Pharaoh is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours. And he's probably standing before Pharaoh by midday. And by that afternoon, he's the prime minister of Egypt. When Joseph woke up that morning, he's still the in-house warden. And by the time he goes to bed that night, he's prime minister of Egypt. It's just bang, 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 bang. Years of preparation, unpleasant preparation, not knowing a timetable, having a vague but certain promise from God. And God puts him into that position. Now, it's still going to be another year before he sees his brothers. And it's going to be 2 years before the family moves down into Egypt to fulfill the whole thing. But God prepares him for that. Sometimes our hardship is God's preparation for something down the road. We grow through some great trials that all kinds of things, your life, my life, you look at how God gets you from point A to point B. If I was planning the course, that is not what I would do. And yet hindsight, in spite of pain, hardship, difficulty, heartbreak, all these things, God gets us from point A to point B, and we can look back and say, you know, the lessons I learned are exactly what I needed to know for where I am now, what God is doing right now. I wouldn't have chosen that. It was hard. It was difficult. And yet God sustained me. I made it here. And the tools that he gave me along the way are exactly what I need to be doing what I'm doing now. And that was the case for Joseph. God sent him there to preserve life. And Joseph, by the way, recognizes that later on. You see that in Genesis. It says in verse 23, Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And he increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies. They were fruitful. They multiplied down there. God took 70 people and turned them during the time they were down in Egypt to probably between 1.5 million and 3 million. And like I said, you sit down with a calculator and you go, yeah, I guess you can do that. You can do that. And so God used that circumstance to grow the nation. By the way, something interesting. We'll finish up with this. When we dealt with biblical separation a number of months ago, and I'm probably going to do that thing. We get enough new folks in here. I'll probably do that again another year, year and a half. One of the things that's an interesting thing is that when Joseph brought his family down into Egypt, he told Pharaoh before they arrived, or just after they arrived, but before Pharaoh had met them, that they were shepherds. All right? Joseph told Pharaoh that his family were shepherds. And then he tells his family, all right, when Pharaoh brings some of you, because it was only going to be, I think it was three or four of his brothers went in before Pharaoh. He says, when you have your audience with Pharaoh, tell him that you are shepherds. He says, because every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. For the Egyptians, it would be like telling a Jew that you keep pigs for a living. Where can I stay in your town, in your country? I keep pigs. All right, that was the Egyptians' view of people who kept sheep. They kept cattle. Cows were sacred in Egypt. Sheep was like pigs as far as a Jew is concerned. All right, so we keep sheep. Oh, is that right? Well, can't mingle with the people now, can we? But you have a favored status even if you are keeping sheep. So, how about Goshen? And that way you can live in a place that's got everything you need, but you will be isolated from the rest of the people. Goshen would be the, western, southwestern part of the Delta area of Egypt. And so, God preserved them as an entity, as a cultural entity, by giving them an enclave that was only theirs. A lot of the commentators will say, oh, they messed up. They weren't supposed to tell Pharaoh. That's not true. Joseph earlier had told Pharaoh. It was a deliberate act to make sure that they would not blend in and disappear into Egypt. It was to maintain their integrity, that they would not become idolaters, that they would maintain their language, they would maintain their culture, they would maintain their identity as the covenant people and not become Egyptians. So God preserved all these things and allowed them to be in Egypt for over 400 years and maintain their national identity, starting out with 70 people, even starting with just a small group of 70. And yet with that, by the time they grew to that huge number, were they polluted by the Egyptians? Yes, we know that. But they were still a separate people, which is why they had been enslaved in the first place. God preserved these folks and protected them and did a great and wonderful thing in spite of the slavery in preparation for what he was going to do with the next step, was to make them a nation on their own. And we'll talk about that next time. Are any additional thoughts or anything on what we've looked at here? Yes?
It's pretty amazing how Joseph understood the separation that he wanted to maintain, whether it was God that gave him the revelation of that or just in his own wisdom that he had to maintain.
Yeah, because here he is trying to serve God. That was why he told the wife of Potiphar that, hey, I can't do this and sin against God. And so here he is trying to serve God, and yet, you know, sometimes we think we're the only Christian. Guess what? He was. He was it. He was the only one serving the true God. Everybody else is an idolater. Everybody. He didn't know anybody outside of his family who were serving the true God. Now, there probably were some, but maybe not in Egypt. He's very much by himself. And so he recognized the pull that the culture would have. And especially, you know, if here he is with a heart devoted to God, do my brothers have the same devotion? Do my brothers have the same intent on remaining pure in their devotion to the Lord? There has to be separation, by the way. And that's true for today. That's true for today. Okay, anything else? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your providence, for your guidance, for your direction. And Father, may we know that you always are present, whether we have a sense of it or not, whether we feel like it or not. Father, you are there and you are working. And Father, I pray that we would devotedly serve you and recognize that your hand is there. And Father, hardship and trial and difficulty may be there. And yet ultimately, Father, we have eternity with you. And anything that we endure in the here and now is nothing compared to what you have for us in the hereafter. So Father, I pray that you would help us to serve you now, Father, with great expectation of not only what you're going to do in the here and now, but also what you have for us for eternity. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.